Hard to forget, I did not finish in 1912 because everyone liked to talk about it.
High compression engines, four-wheel brakes, front-wheel drive, straight-eight engine, multiple carburetor, even the rear vision mirror.
I go down the backstretch singing, oh boy, I'm lucky, I'll say I'm lucky. Every time I cross a line, all alone, $100.
We played baseball for an hour and a half to 2 hours every day in the infield by the garages.
Back in 1930, he won $52,100.
When a driver doesn't make it to the starting line and gets paid as much money as I had got in three wins, then you're born 50 years too soon.
If I hadn't have bought it, it would have been subdivided, and Indiana and Indianapolis would have lost the one big thing they've got that's known around the world.
This is the history of the 500. I'm Steve Simpson, and this hour, we'll look back at the broad era after the first Indianapolis 500 in 1911 until World War II. We'll detail some of the early changes and traditions that have withstood the test of time, and we'll profile the Speedway's owners in its first three decades. But first, a look at the on-track happenings during those early years. Inaugural race winner Ray Haroon does not try to make it two straight in 1912, having begun his retirement from racing. The total purse nearly doubles to $50,000. It seems a foregone conclusion that Italian-born Ralph De Palma will take advantage of the increased prize money. He takes the lead on lap three and stays there the rest of the way. Well, almost. With 25 laps remaining, his car begins to fail. He coasts to a stop with just over a lap to go. De Palma and his riding mechanic attempt to push the car the rest of the way. They don't get very far before Indianapolis native Joe Dawson speeds by and takes the win. In 1913, Frenchman Jules Gou coasts to a 13-minute win and, according to legend, sips champagne during several pit stops. 1914 sees another Frenchman, René Thomas, take the checkered flag. In 1915, De Palma leads 132 laps. This time he has no trouble going the full 500 miles and claims victory. Decades later, De Palma reflected on his 1912 heartbreak and his 1915 triumph with IMS Radio Network anchor Sid Collins.
Hard to forget the one I did not finish in 1912 because everyone liked to talk about it.
That's right.
Everyone reads about it. There have been more lines written about the race that I did not win than there did on the one that I did win in 1915. Of course, they call it hard luck. Well, I often say that I don't think it was hard luck. It's just breaks of the game.
The 1916 race is shortened to 300 miles. The Speedway actually enters seven cars to create a fuller field. None of them finish in the top five. Italian-born but self-proclaimed Englishman Dario Resta takes the checkered flag first. A second race takes place in 1916 at the Speedway. Speedway historian Donald Davidson explains.
It seems to be they did have another event planned for 1911, which they canceled. You don't hear anything more about it. And then I think from that point on, other than for special events where they would do like a mock race for some visiting dignitary, it wasn't until 1916 that they actually scheduled another race. I mean, there were rumors about what they were going to do, but it was in 1916 they ran a 300-mile race, and supposedly that was to help with the war effort. Well, actually, Fisher thought that the race was too long and that the public wanted a 300-mile race, which is what, and they didn't. So for 1917, they were going to go back to 500. But anyway, in I think it was September the 9th, 10th, 11th, somewhere in there, they had what they called the Harvest Day Classic. And they ran three races in one day, and they had a 20-mile, a 50-mile, and a 100-mile race using the same cars, and Johnny Aiken won all three of those. But they said, okay, for next year, we'll go back to just the 500 only, and then, of course, World War I intervenes, and it's 1919 before they're back.
The 500 returns in 1919 with a temporary name change for patriotic reasons. The race is rechristened the Liberty Sweepstakes. For the first time, the field contains the now familiar number of 33 cars. However, the 33-car starting grid will not become a permanent fixture until 1934. Crawfordsville, Indiana's Howdy Wilcox is the first to break the 100-mile-per-hour barrier during time trials. Wilcox leads 98 laps and wins the race. In 1920, only 23 cars are on the starting grid. A famous last name wins the race, Gaston Chevrolet, younger brother of Chevrolet founder Louis. He completes the 500 miles on one set of tires. With his first win in 1921 and his second in 1923, Tommy Milton becomes the first two-time 500 champ. Milton's feat is even more impressive considering he only has one functional eye. Milton would later contribute as chief steward of the Speedway. Sandwiched between Milton's two wins is Jimmy Murphy's 1922 victory. The car is the same one he drove to victory at the French Grand Prix in 1921. In 1924, Joe Boyer drives two different cars. In his original entry, he qualifies fourth and is relieved on lap 109. That car eventually crashes. Boyer relieves LL Corum on lap 111. He charges to the front and leads the last 24 laps. Corum and Boyer are scored as co-winners. That's the first time that's happened in Indianapolis 500 history. The 1925 race is the first to average over 100 miles an hour. Peter DiPaolo pulls out to a huge lead. He gives way to a relief driver for 20 laps to rest blistering fingers. DiPaolo returns and stays trouble-free for the victory.
All through the race, I had the confidence that I was going to win. Matter of fact, I'd sing. I'd go down the backstretch singing, oh boy, I'm lucky, I'll say I'm lucky.
DiPaolo's uncle was 1915 winner Ralph DePalma. Rain halts the 1926 race at lap 72 and ends it at lap 160. Rookie Frank Lockhart wins by two laps, making him the fourth rookie winner. Lockhart seems on his way to two straight in 1928 before dropping out with a broken rod. His loss turns out to be rookie George Souter's gain. Following the 1927 500, Carl Fisher and James Allison sell the Indianapolis Motor Speedway to World War I flying ace Eddie Rickenbacker. In 1928, a third straight rookie driver wins and a new star is born. Despite starting 13th and leading just 19 laps, Louis Meyer wins the first of his three Indianapolis 500s. Meyer's plan to race at Indy was apparently news to his own wife.
I didn't know even in 28 that he had a car. And I had picked up a wrecked car on the road and the mechanics had fixed it up for me. And I said to one of the mechanics, let's run up to see Eddie race in Reading. When we got up to the racetrack in, where Eddie was racing, I heard them announce over the radio that give Eddie Meyer the hand, the brother of the winner of Indianapolis race. And that's the first I knew that he had a car to drive.
Meyer leads a race-high 65 laps in 1929, but Ray Keach inherits the lead when Meyer's engine gives up after a pit stop. Keach leads the rest of the way. Keach loses his life in a racing accident in Tipton, Pennsylvania, just 16 days later. Billy Arnold wins the 1930 500 in dominating fashion, leading 198 laps, a record that still stands. Arnold leads 155 laps in 1931, but crashes in turn four, paving the way for Louis Schneider to take the win. Fred Frame wins in 1932 after several strong showings in previous 500s, including a runner-up finish in 1931. The 1933 500 is delayed 15 minutes because the drivers threatened to boycott the race in support of Howdy Wilcox II, who had finished second in 1932 and qualified sixth in 1933. He's discovered, though, to have had diabetes in the days leading up to the race and ruled ineligible by the track physician because of fears of a seizure, which proved to be inaccurate. The drivers finally end their boycott threat at the urging of Louis Meyer. Meyer goes on to win, becoming the 500's second two-time winner. 42 cars start the race, still the most in 500 history. In 1934, the popular Bill Cummings, who lived his entire life in Indianapolis, beats Maury Rose by 27 seconds, then the closest finish in 500 history. Despite numerous attempts to improve participant safety by requiring crash helmets and installing green and yellow lights around the track, the month of May in 1935 is one of the worst in terms of fatalities. 9 days before the race, two drivers and a riding mechanic lose their lives. Another driver, Clay Weatherly, perishes in the race in one of the cars that had been repaired after the May 21st fatal crashes. Rex Mays leads most of the first 300 miles before dropping out with mechanical failure. Kelly Patello takes over and wins with a record-breaking average speed of more than 115 miles an hour. Following the 1935 fatalities, the Speedway mandates rookie tests starting in 1936. The Speedway also adjusts the configuration of the turns, removes the inside walls, and repaves the straightaways with tarmac, replacing the bricks. 1936 is a year of firsts. Louis Meyer becomes the first three-time winner, the first presented the BorgWarner Trophy, the first to receive a pace car for winning, and the first to drink milk in Victory Lane, albeit buttermilk. Many years later, Meyer noted the relatively small purse in his day.
When a driver doesn't make it to the starting line and gets paid as much money as I had got in three wins, then you're born 50 years too soon.
In 1937, another Indianapolis Motor Speedway legend wins his first 500 in the closest race until 1982. Late in the race, Wilbur Shaw leads Ralph Hepburn by over a lap. But with about 20 laps to go, Shaw's car begins leaking oil, and the right rear tire is heavily worn. Shaw slows considerably, hoping to nurse his car to the finish. He and his riding mechanic are also dealing with burns from leaking oil. Hepburn unlaps himself and continues to make up ground. On the final lap, Hepburn pulls within reach. Some observers say Hepburn even overtakes Shaw momentarily on the backstretch. Shaw holds off Hepburn by 2.16 seconds. The late 1930s are tainted by several fatalities at the Speedway. In 1938, a spectator, Everett Spence, lost his life when a wheel comes off a car and flies some 100 feet through the air and strikes him. The winner in 1938, Floyd Roberts, is involved in a fatal accident on the backstretch of the Brickyard the next year. In 1939 and 1940, Wilbur Shaw becomes the first driver to win two straight 500s. It also marks three wins in 4 years for Shaw, joining Louis Meyer as a three-time winner. His only non-victory in that span is a second-place finish in 1938. In 1941, a race morning garage fire destroys George Behringer's revolutionary rear-engine car and keeps him from starting. Maury Rose is on the pole for former driver-turned-legendary car owner Lou Moore, but drops out early with mechanical trouble. Rose relieves teammate Floyd Davis on lap 72 and comes from 11th place to win. Davis and Rose are credited as the Indianapolis 500's second set of co-winners. With America's involvement in World War II, auto racing is banned, and the Indianapolis Motor Speedway is abandoned and falls into disrepair. The future of the 500 is uncertain until the fall of 1945, when Tony Holman arrives on the scene and resurrects the track and the race. Up next, a look at some of the many changes in this era predating World War II. This is the history of the 500.
This is the history of the 500. I'm Kevin Lee. One man, more than any other, is responsible for the idea and creation of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and the Indianapolis 500. As a local car dealer, Carl Fisher had a vested interest in the advancement of the automotive industry. Speedway historian Donald Davidson.
The city of Indianapolis was one of the centers of the automobile industry. The problem was now, how do you test an automobile? Well, you do it on the open road. And as Carl Fisher was to start lobbying very early on, some states were appropriating funds for the development of roads, and Indiana was not one of them. As far as I know, there wasn't a paved road in the entire state. Well, it got to the point where they couldn't find out how fast it would go because the roads were so bad. So for a while, they used the state fairgrounds, the very track where the Hoosier 100 is run today, the 1 mile, and it had reasonably long straightaways and fairly gradual turns, except that by the time they were getting to like 50, 60 miles an hour, the cars were top heavy and they were slowing over, you know, in the turns and everything. And so by 1904, 1905, then the thinking was, we need a bigger track.
We don't know exactly when Fisher began thinking about building a track, but as early as 1906, a letter from Fisher was published in Motor Age magazine detailing his idea of a testing track between 3 and 5 miles in length. He also writes he'd been considering the idea for up to 3 years. Jerry Fisher is a relative of Carl Fisher and the author of The Pace Setter, The Untold Story of Carl G. Fisher.
He could see the future, and he knew that the automobiles were going to be a big factor in the public in the future. However, the public at that time had little confidence, and they were really scared and nervous about these automobiles. So Carl really thought that, you know, the public has to be sold on these automobiles, and what better way to do it than to make a racetrack so that people could see and have confidence in the automobiles.
The state fairgrounds in Indianapolis was considered, but there was not enough land. An area in French Lick was also proposed, but it was too hilly. Time passed, and a racing track was still just a vision of Carl Fisher's.
At some point in the fall of 1908, they were coming back from a trip. Carl Fisher and a friend named Lem Trotter, who was into real estate and very much of a local politician, apparently they were coming through Dublin, which is on 40, and it was dirt, and something that broke down or another tire puncture or something, And Fisher got out, and he was known to blaspheme with regularity and with great ease, and cursing and swearing about, you know, the state of automobiles and tires and the equipment. And if only they could have this track that he'd been talking about, you know, they could solve a lot of these problems. So Trotter, his friend, says, well, you've been talking about this for years. Why don't you build it?
Within a few days, Trotter took Fisher to see 4 80-acre tracts of farmland that were for sale about 5 miles northwest of downtown Indianapolis at the corner of the Crawfordsville Pike and, most importantly, next to a railroad station. The area was known as the Old Presley Farm. Fisher then recruited 4 other partners to help him finance the project. James Allison was a partner of Fisher's in the Prestolite Automobile Headlight Company, and within a few years, the founder of Allison Engineering. Arthur Newby was head of the National Motor Vehicle Company. Frank Wheeler was a partner in the Wheeler Schebler Carburetor Company. The 5th partner, Stoughton Fletcher, who was involved in the banking industry, soon pulled out because of concerns and pressure from the family, but helped with loans. Fisher and Allison put the most money in and were the senior partners. The land was purchased in December of 1908, and by February of 09, newspapers detailed plans of the Indiana Motor Parkway. Early on, there was also more to the idea than just a testing track. The idea for races was another way for manufacturers to market their cars via stripped-down versions in competition, but they could also develop a sports. Charles Learson is the author of the 2011 book Blood and Smoke, A True Tale of Mystery, Mayhem, and the Birth of the Indy 500.
They saw the popularity of auto racing on the roads, but they realized that there was a problem watching road races, that you couldn't see the whole race from wherever you were sitting, and that the promoters couldn't put a gate around it and charge you to get in. So that was an even bigger problem. So no one could make money off it, really.
Next was to come up with a design.
At one point, they were looking at trying to build a 3-mile track. It would fit, but there was no room for grandstands on the outside. And so the engineer, legend has it that what he had done was to draw a 1-mile circle on a piece of cardboard to scale. Each turn today is exactly 1/4 mile from entrance to exit. And so what he had done, he drew this circle to scale, cut out the piece of cardboard, and then quartered it like 4 pizza pieces, and then laid it on the map of the land that they had, and then pushed it to the parameters and drew in the straightaways. They said, well, what do you suggest? And he said, well, with shorter straightaways, it would pull the whole thing in, and I could give you a 2.5-mile track, and that would fit.
There was also a 2.5-mile infield road course planned that connected the oval to make a separate course or a 5-mile course if desired. Construction of the track began in late March of 1909. After early issues with the surface and a creek running through the facility, the road course was abandoned. While work on the track progressed, the first event took place, the U.S. National Balloon Championships, on June 5th of 1909. After delays caused the cancellation of July 4th auto races, a motorcycle program was first up on the 2.5-mile oval for August 13th and 14th. It did not go well.
Friday the 13th of August rained out. So when did the Speedway have its first rain out? Over 100 years ago. Well, as it turned out, Saturday was a disaster and a lot of accidents. The track was in terrible shape. Many riders refused to run. And so some events that were supposed to have like 20, 30 contestants may have had 3 or 4. There were several injuries, and the officials came to the management and said, look, you know, we're going to cancel the rest of the program and we're not going to come back on Monday.
For trivia, the final event was won by Irwin Baker, later known as Cannonball Baker, who raced in the 1922 500, was the first commissioner of NASCAR, and became known for his cross-country cannonball runs. Next up were cars the next weekend. The first event, a 5-mile race, was won by Louis Switzer, later the longtime technical director of the 500. Some other names we now know were in the first car events at IMS that weekend. Louis Chevrolet and Ray Haroon were among the winners. Barney Oldfield, Louis Strang, Johnny Aiken, and Ralph DePalma also competed. The third day attracted an estimated 35,000 people. But like the motorcycle events, this weekend also did not go well.
They did get in the 3 days, but they didn't finish the final event. The crushed rock and tar broke up terribly. There were a number of accidents. There was a fatality, a driver by the name of Billy Bork, who actually won an event. And then later the same day was fatally injured in a later event, the same day of his victory. And so then the final event was the Wheeler-Schebler Trophy, a 300-mile race. They had this massive trophy, which I think stood about 8 feet high. It's in the Speedway's museum today. And so this was a 300-mile race. It was finally stopped after 235 miles, but they had already gone beyond 4 hours, so it was getting late in the day, and they had two very bad accidents, a couple of fatalities. It was mutually decided between AAA, the contest board of the American Automobile Association, was the sanctioning body. They came down to the four owners, and it was agreed, look, we can't do this. It's a bloodbath. The surface appears to be the problem. You'll have to come up with a new surface.
So they needed to pave the track. Concrete was considered, but concrete would not survive Indiana winters. So large paving bricks were chosen, which was commonly used on many downtown streets in major cities at the time. The first load arrived on September 18, 1909. After a test determined the bricks would work, the last of the approximately 3.2 million bricks were laid on December 10th. Demonstrations took place on December 17th, with Louis Strang hitting over 111 miles per hour for a quarter mile. Locals were already now referring to the speedway as the Brickyard. In 1910, multiple events were again planned, with three-day events scheduled for Memorial Day, July 4th, and Labor Day weekend, plus an aviation meet and a 24-hour race for August 12th, which was ultimately canceled in July.
What they would run was a series of events in a day's time, maybe 7-8 races in a day. And typically they would be short events, 2-lap standing start dashes, 4-lap standing start dashes. But, you know, remember at the speeds that they were running, it would take, you know, quite a few minutes to run these things off. And then at the end of the day, they would have a longer race, maybe 100 miles. But they were for all different classifications of automobile that you could buy. The whole concept being you sit in the stands and watch the events and decide what you're going to buy.
Ray Haroon won two of the races on Memorial Day weekend, including on the final day, May 30th, in front of an estimated 50 to 60,000 people, exactly 1 year before his most famous win. The air show featuring the Wright brothers was next, but it drew significantly fewer people during the week-long run, possibly in part to the ability to watch from outside the grounds. One of the Wright brothers' planes set the world record for altitude that weekend. The next racing event was over the 4th of July weekend, but crowds were much smaller than May, leading Fisher to cancel the August event and shorten the September schedule by a day. The September crowd also failed to meet expectations, topping out at 15,000 on Labor Day. Haroon won a pair of 5-mile races. Author Charles Learson.
It became pretty obvious that it was the longer races that people liked the most, the big marathons. They wanted to see one big, glorious, epic event, and they wanted to see someone crowned the champion. They wanted to see young men risk their lives over this long haul and someone emerge as the victor. Carl Fisher actually wanted to have a 1,000-mile race, and his partners, he was always a little too exuberant and thinking too big, and those guys said, no, that race will take 12 hours or 15 hours, and it's too much for people to bear. Let's have something they can watch in the course of an afternoon. So they came up with the 500-mile thing. And, you know, this was one of those cases where it was pure luck in a way, because they hit upon something that the public really responded to, not just the public, but the racing industry.
So on September 7th, 1910, the 1911 racing schedule was announced, and it included just one event. Tuesday, May 30th, 1911, Decoration Day, which was also known as Memorial Day. The first Indianapolis 500 was set. Up next, we'll look back to that first race. This is the history of the 500.
This is the history of the 500. I'm Steve Simpson. When talking about Indianapolis 500 traditions, the BorgWarner Trophy is one of the longest lasting. Three-time race winner Louis Meyer once said winning the BorgWarner Trophy is like winning an Olympic gold medal. While the race winner doesn't win the trophy per se, he does get to see his likeness on it, along with his name and the year of his victory. The winner and his team owner each take home a miniature replica of the trophy, commonly known as the Baby Borg. Its first public appearance was during a dinner in New York City in February of 1936. Speedway historian Donald Davidson tells us how the trophy came into existence.
There was a trophy called the Wheeler-Schebler Trophy. In fact, it's in the museum. And Frank Wheeler and George Schebler, Wheeler being one of the four partners in the track, put this thing up for a major event to be held in 1909 and 1910. Along with several other major trophies that would be contested for annually. And with the coming of the first 500-mile race, and that was the only race they ran, several of these trophies sort of put on mothballs for a short time. And then in 1914, they said, well, look, now we're running only this one race a year. Let's bring some of these trophies out and give them for other things. So they had like the 100-mile, 200-mile, 300-mile, 400-mile distance. And Wheeler Shebler was the award for leading at 400 miles. The original deed was that a manufacturer that won it three times would retire it. Well, by the time you get into the 30s, you don't have manufacturers. You have car owners. And Harry Hart's former driver, his cars had led in 1932. They led at the 400-mile mark for the third consecutive time, as it turns out. So he got possession of the trophy. And it was around that time that Bog Warner Corporation was being formed. I believe that there were four companies all kind of merged to come under the Bog Warner umbrella, if you like. And one of those companies was what had been Wheeler Shebler. But the trophy had recently been retired, and so some conversation evidently took place. They said, well, there's no permanent trophy for the 500. There's several awards, and there was the Strauss Trophy, which was a downtown department store, and it was different every year. It went all the way back to the very beginning, but it was a piece of artwork, and sometimes commissioned, and sometimes something that they had purchased in Europe, and it might be 50 or 100 years old. So then when they thought, well, there's no permanent trophy, they announced either in May or certainly early June of 35 that they were going to have a trophy commissioned, and it would be called the Man of Motors Trophy. Well, it ended up not ever being called that.
On the trophy are sculptures of the faces of every Indianapolis 500 winner. The repeat winners see their faces as many times as they won the race. There's one likeness of a person who never won the race. That would be Speedway savior Tony Holman, whose image was added in 1987. Scott Gillette, BorgWarner's vice president of marketing and public relations, says BorgWarner and the Speedway were a good match from the beginning.
BorgWarner has always been synonymous with technology and innovation, and racing often captures a lot of those same characteristics, and we just thought it's a good match. It's really reflective of what our company always tries to achieve.
The creation of the trophy cost BorgWarner $10,000 in the middle of the Great Depression. Gillette says it was a worthwhile investment.
Many people value it at different ranges today, upwards of $1.5 million, I have heard, but we really consider it priceless. There's just no way that that history could ever be recreated.
Even when BorgWarner first unveiled the trophy, the faces of the winning drivers up to that time were already sculpted on it. Now, you may think at some point there would be no more room for new faces, and you would be right. But Davidson says BorgWarner was aware of that, and they did something about it.
Finally, 1986, the thing filled up, and the question had been for a number of years, what are they going to do when the trophy fills up? And then one of the popular theories was, well, BorgWarner's going to get out. Well, guess what? They designed a base onto which the trophy would go, and then the base filled up in 2004, I believe. And so they built a new base.
There's enough room now to add the face of every 500 winner through the 2034 race. With the base, the trophy is about 5.5 feet tall and weighs in at 110 pounds. Another tradition was born in 1936, the race winner drinking milk in Victory Lane. Louis Meyer asked for a glass of buttermilk after winning the 1936 500. Milk was part of every post-race celebration by the mid-50s. Since then, only one driver has deviated from the script.
No, I'm not having the milk since.
Yeah, put that freak on.
Now there's a first. Emerson, you're not going to drink the milk.
Well, I'm going to drink the orange juice. That's my producing, and I'm going to have this time orange juice. I produce orange juice.
Back in Sao Paulo, Brazil, he produces the orange juice, so he's going to go that way.
That was Emerson Fittipaldi after winning the 1993 500. He did take a sip of milk later on. However, he was soundly booed during driver introductions at Milwaukee the following weekend. Emo later apologized.
Back home again in Indiana, and it seems...
Many of the race's notable traditions occur before the green flag waves. The singing of Back Home Again in Indiana is the last item on the agenda before the command to start engines. Back Home Again is not the state song of Indiana, but maybe more recognized than On the Banks of the Wabash. The song was first published in 1917, and this annual moment has taken place since 1946 at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Jim Nabors first sang the song in 1972. For some, like longtime auto racing commentator Robin Miller, this has made Jim Nabors even more famous than his acting career.
He's part of the tradition, and people look forward to it, and he loves it. I mean, I think he probably did it as a lark the first time they invited him, and everybody thought, God, this guy can really sing. That was good. It's part of his act. I mean, he's become part of the Indianapolis 500 mainstream scenery. That's Jim Nabors. Everybody knows who he is, and I'm not sure, what can the kids in the 20s and 30s, do they even have any idea who that he was Gomer Pyle? I don't know that they do.
A more recent tradition is Hallman George family friend Florence Henderson singing God Bless America. Ms. Henderson previously sang America the Beautiful for most of the 90s, but switched to God Bless America in 2003. The Indianapolis 500 takes place on Memorial Weekend, giving the Speedway the opportunity to honor fallen veterans of the United States military. Taps is played and sometimes preceded by remarks from either current or retired military personnel. Notable speakers have included General Colin Powell and General Norman Schwarzkopf. This is a very emotional moment, according to broadcaster Bob Jenkins.
The whole buildup to it is indescribable. And when you wake up on race morning and you know that is the day that you've been waiting for, is just something that I can't begin to explain to you. Arriving at the track, and especially the ceremonies before the command to start engines, are the most emotional 20 minutes that I experience during the year. I'm not hesitant or ashamed to tell you that I have tears streaming down my cheeks when taps are played and when Back Home Again in Indiana is sung.
And of course, there's the command to start engines. Three-time race winner Wilbur Shaw started that custom in 1946 when he was the Speedway's president. After Shaw perished in a plane crash in 1954, Tony Hallman continued the tradition until his death in 1977, making it one of Robin Miller's favorites.
You always like to see Tony Hallman say, gentlemen, start your engines, because he put so much emotion. It was like he was turning a key. That's, if you ever watch the films, it shows him kind of turning the key. Gentlemen, start your engines. And that was always I think that and the balloons going up, because you knew that the bombs were going off.
Hallman's widow, Mary Fendrick Hallman, did the honors until 1997. Daughter Mary Hallman George has said the most famous words in motorsports ever since. Race morning is a tradition unto itself. Speedway historian Donald Davidson explains this is what keeps bringing people back year after year.
I haven't really talked to people recently, but I know that for many, many years you had these families. Sometimes there might be, 18, 20 people in an entourage that would live in Speedway. They either drove to the track and parked in somebody's yard, or they lived in the area and they would walk to the track. They would always come the same route. They would have their little rituals that they would do every year, and they would all sort of be in their same seats at the same time. People used to do this for qualifying, and I don't think anybody's doing that now. With non-reserve seats, you'd see the same people in the same seats every year with the same coolers. Well, anyway, everybody stands for taps. That's always has been a hugely emotional time, no matter how rowdy the infield crowd may have been. When Taps was performed, everybody sort of stood to attention, and that when it was announced, you could look across the way from the vantage point I've always been fortunate enough to have, and you see these thousands and thousands and thousands of people standing up, and then the hats coming off, and even some people wiping a tear away, because it's a very emotional time. And then Back Home Again in Indiana. One time, of course, Jim Nabors hadn't done it, and then he did it the first year, and I think people thought, oh, what's Gomer doing here? And then he came back, and after a few years, it was sort of a major disaster if he wasn't there. And I remember there was one year he had a health issue, and there was some doubt as to whether he was going to be here or not. And he showed up at the last minute, and when he was announced, he got the most thunderous ovation just about that I think I've ever heard. And he was looking down because he didn't want to be disturbed by looking at all the people. And the people were waving and holding up programs. Thousands and thousands of people. That was a very special moment.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The History of the 500. In our next episode, we look back to the era after World War II through the 1950s. I'm Steve Simpson. This is the history of the 500. I'm Steve Simpson. There have been only three groups that have owned the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. The Hallman George family has been in charge since late 1945. And before that, two groups, interesting individuals who made their names in much more than auto racing. Carl Graham Fisher is certainly the most well-known and most significant member of the founding fathers of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. But Fisher's vision could not have been realized without help. After toying with the idea of a motor speedway for several years, in 1909, Fisher recruited three partners in a venture to promote the automotive industry, what became the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. James Allison was a partner of Fisher's in the Prestolite Automobile Headlight Company. And within a few years, the founder of Allison Engineering, Frank Wheeler, was a partner in the Wheeler Schebler Carburetor Company. There was also originally a fifth partner, Stoughton Fletcher, who was also involved in the banking industry, but Fletcher soon pulled out because of concerns about the project from his family. But he did help with loans. Of note, still today, the four elementary schools in Speedway are named for the founding fathers of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Fisher and Allison put the most money in and were the senior partners and the most hands-on. Speedway historian Donald Davidson.
Allison was always in the background, and I think that what happened was that Fisher became more and more involved in Miami. I mean, he was back and forth and maintained residence here. And I think it was like around 21 or 22 that he no longer lived in the house that he owned, which is now part of Marion University. And so it was shortly after the 1923 race, I think it was in June of 23, he actually turned the presidency of the track over to Allison. And Allison sort of headed it up. But they basically ran the 500 each year, and there was private testing went out there. They didn't have any other events. So as far as being hands-on, I don't know that Allison really spent a great deal of time at the track. I think he was, just a few blocks to the south in Allison Engineering.
James A. Allison, born in Marcellus, Michigan, was an American entrepreneur and businessman, much like Carl Fisher. Allison moved to Indianapolis with his parents in 1880. He quit school and joined his father's business, Allison Coupon Company, at age 12 in 1884. Just 6 years later, with the untimely death of his father, James assumed the vice presidency of the company at age 18. Allison Coupon Company still exists today as Allison Payment Systems. During the 1890s, Allison became intrigued by the bicycle trade that was sweeping the nation. He joined the Indianapolis-based Bicycle Zigzag Club, where he met Carl Fisher. Fisher and Allison would remain confidants the rest of their lives. Allison and Fisher complemented each other well. Len Trotter, a mutual business colleague and the man who showed Fisher the location of the Speedway, said of Allison, quote, "Fisher was the dreamer, but Allison had the most brilliant mind of any man I ever knew. He was the industrialist."
And it was an interesting relationship because Fisher seemed to have had a very short attention span. I mean, he was running 100 miles an hour all the time with this idea and that idea, and that Allison was was sort of like the stabilizing force. I mean, Fisher wanted to, he was trying to get the Olympic Games. he offered the Speedway, or at least actually went after the Olympic Games for the track and field for the 1912 season, which didn't happen. But he wanted this to be an aviation headquarters, no sooner had he got his balloon license than he and the fellow he was working with, Captain George Bumbor, they were trying to figure ways to fly the Atlantic in a balloon. And I don't know that he'd been out of state yet. So anyway, the thing is that he had all of these grand ideas that he would chase after, but he would jump from thing to thing, and that Allison was the one that, you know, kind of reasoned with him a little bit. The thinking was that when they were talking about having the 500-mile race, somebody suggested that Fisher probably said, let's have a 1,000-mile race, and that it was Allison that said, no, wait a minute now, that's going to take too long to run.
Allison formed the Indianapolis Speedway Team Company to engineer race cars for the Indianapolis 500. The machine shop was located on the same grounds as Prestolite, directly across the street from the Speedway, until Prestolite was sold in 1917. The company engineered the car that won the 1919 race with Howdy Wilcox. The company then retooled for World War I, becoming a major defense contractor as Allison Experimental Company. Renamed as Allison Engineering Company in the 1920s, the company was acquired by General Motors in 1929. Frank Wheeler claimed to have lost two fortunes before arriving in Indianapolis in 1904 and joining George Schebler to manufacture carburetors. Their forum sponsored Indy's first trophy, a towering Tiffany Cup. Wheeler tried to duplicate the Speedway with a Minnesota track. After that venture failed, he sold his Speedway interest to Allison in 1917. He took his own life in 1921 at the age of 57, apparently despondent over his failing health, in part due to diabetes. Arthur C. Newby was born in 1865 in Monrovia, Indiana, southwest of Indianapolis. Like Allison and Fisher, he was involved in the bicycle business and was also widely known for his philanthropic efforts. As Fisher began to concentrate on other projects in the late teens and 20s, Allison took on a more prominent role and replaced Fisher as track president in 1923. Newby remained a partner but was not involved in the operation. The Fisher-Allison Group maintained ownership until 1927, when the next leader of the world's greatest race course took over. Less than a year after the sale, James Allison died of pneumonia in 1928. Newby died in 1933, and Fisher, who lost almost all of his fortune because of a hurricane that destroyed his Miami Beach development and then the Great Depression, died in 1939 of a stomach hemorrhage after a lengthy illness. Fisher and Allison sold the facility on November 1, 1927. The buyer was Edward Vernon Rickenbacker, an American fighter ace in World War I and a Medal of Honor recipient. Speedway historian Donald Davidson.
Eddie Rickenbacker was pretty stern of personality, I think, through much of his life. He came from very meager beginnings and was actually a driver in the first few 500s, not all of them, but he was a relief driver in 1911, and then he left in 1916 to go to Europe and then came back as World War I flying ace, and it seems to be that from that point on, then he was a very proud man, very successful. So he headed up an automobile company, which actually failed, and continued to be involved with the government and was often expressing his opinion whether or not it was wanted. And he went very quickly from being invited in 1926 to serving on the contest board of the American Automobile Association. He was invited to serve as a member, and it was something like maybe 3 or 4 months he was the chairman of the board. And then shortly after that, he became the owner of title of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. So in a very short time, he went from being invited to being a board member to being the chairman of the sanctioning body, as well as the owner, you know, effectively the owner of the track.
Rickenbacker owned the Speedway for nearly two decades and oversaw many improvements. He also spent some time playing the role of promoter.
Well, high compression engines, for instance, four-wheel brakes, front-wheel drive, straight-eight engines, multiple carburetors. Even the rear vision mirror, they all appeared first on the famous Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
Once the Speedway operations were under control, Rickenbacker looked for additional opportunities for entrepreneurship, including in sales for the Cadillac division of General Motors and for various aircraft manufacturers and airlines. Rickenbacker's most lasting business endeavor was his longtime leadership of Eastern Airlines. Through the 1920s, he had worked with and for General Motors. First as a California distributor for its new car, the short-lived Sheridan, then later as a marketer for the LaSalle, and finally as vice president of sales for one of their affiliates, an aircraft company. He persuaded GM to purchase North American Aviation, a conglomerate whose assets included Eastern Air Transport. GM asked him to manage Eastern beginning in 1935. With the help of some friends, Rickenbacker merged Eastern Air Transport and Florida Airways to form Eastern Airlines, an airline that eventually grew from a company flying a few thousand miles per week into a major airline. In April 1938, after learning that GM was considering selling Eastern to John D. Hertz, Rickenbacker met with GM's chairman of the board, Alfred P. Sloan, and bought the company for $3.5 million. After the 500-mile race in 1941, Rickenbacker closed the Speedway due to World War II. He sold the track in 1945 to businessman Tony Hallman Jr. Eddie Rickenbacker suffered from a stroke while he was in Switzerland seeking special medical treatment for Adelaide Rickenbacker, his wife. He then contracted pneumonia. He died on July 23, 1973 in Zurich, Switzerland, and then his body was interred in Columbus, Ohio, at the Green Lawn Cemetery. The United States Postal Service issued a postage stamp in honor of Rickenbacker's accomplishments as an aviation pioneer in 1995. Up next, a look at some of the lasting traditions of the Indianapolis 500. This is the history of the 500.